does that computer know who you are?
Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. Behold the glory that is
in a little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
thing. I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Windows Vista machine.
You'd think
there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk.
Good morning. This is Tech Talk. This is Michael Tech Talk Kassler on WRLR 98.3 LPFM, and I believe he's a little fuzzy. Dave, are you there with? Is that you with us? No, maybe not. I don't know. it's the usual. With Target. So it's kind of like if you didn't get nailed by the Target mess up, then you got hit by Jewel and Super Value. And, you know, what happened is they believe that malicious hackers targeted the part of Super Value's network specifically that handles the credit card transactions. So that means that they've got stolen credit card information, they've got expiration dates, card numbers, and potentially, and they're not 100% sure, but potentially cardholders' names as well. So that's a considerable amount of information, and certainly enough to build a profile on someone and put it together to do some identity theft, things like that. Now, you combine that, of course, too, with the recent reports of, you know, Russian hackers grabbing tons and tons of data and everything else, and you just keep getting pounded into your head the idea that, you know what, your data is not your data, and your identity is not safe. It's not a safe identity. So, you know, it's really tough. It's really tough to, you know, even at this point, although we've given so many thoughts and concepts and ideas about how to protect yourself and to make sure that your information and identity is safe online, it's very, very difficult these days to give a consistent response and say, yeah, absolutely, if you do these X, Y, and Z things, you're going to be safe. Because the bottom line is, you're not. It doesn't matter how many times you change your password. That's going to help a little bit, but at some point, you know, it's just as likely as any other that that it's going to happen. I think the best solution out there today now is if you can grab onto and make use of two-layer authentication. That's really what it comes down to, and that's the thing that I'm going to promote to people from here on out. I don't care how easy to crack your password is, the thing of it is, of course, is that in most cases, people are not quote-unquote cracking your password. This is an example of where these individuals here, these hackers who got Super Value's network, they don't have to crack your password. If they get a password, they've got your password. They're not sitting there running through and chugging and churning through, 20 million real words and exclamation points and other stuff to see if they can figure out what your password is. They got it. They got it right there. It's done. And they're going to use it. And so you want to make sure you use different passwords at every site, but any site that offers you two-layer authentication, jump on it. Grab it. Two-layer authentication, in case you haven't been exposed to it, and if you're a Google user, you have this available to you automatically, is a combination of things. What it does is it allows you to have your password, but then in addition, the second layer is you identify when you set that account up, or after the fact if you need to, another way to confirm your identity that you feel is secure. So for me personally, I use my phone as an additional identifier. So you could get my Google Mail password, which would give you access theoretically to all of my mail, all of my documents online, you know, anything I'm storing and saving and working with Google through, in addition to, of course, anything that uses Google as an additional authentication factor. And that's a whole other topic. But because I use dual authentication, the two-layer authentication, you cannot just have my password and start accessing all my info. Because as soon as you try to get in there, with my password, it's going to say, okay, great. We got your password. We think you might be you. I'm going to send a text or voice mail to your phone that you identified earlier with a special code. And you're going to need that code in order to get in as well. So really, really good stuff. Really good stuff. If you look at it that way, and that's the way to do it. I think that's how I'm promoting anyways.
Michael.
Oh, hey. Oh my gosh. Wait, Dave. I don't believe it. I've been sitting here like, they say it's a myth, the left brain, right brain thing.
Yeah.
but I've been doing this thing where I put half of my brain kind of in autopilot talking about yet another. I mean, it's easy to do because there's been so many of them, but I put it in autopilot. Let's just tell people how to deal with yet another security breach while the other half of my brain is wildly dashing around pushing buttons on the board and seeing if we can figure out what's going on.
Well, apparently you hit the right one because I can actually hear you at this point. So the super value data breach you're talking about, were that passwords stolen? Is that actually like PIN numbers?
So what they actually stole, at least according to the information that I've got right now, was a lot of information. They got credit card info, they got expiration dates, numbers, and also names. So you can use, I mean, with an expiration date, your name. Now, they don't have that little special, number at the back. I can't remember what that's called. But everything but, and that's usually enough to start using it, I guess.
Yeah.
Depends on
data breaches are nothing new. The size of them seem to be getting incomprehensibly bigger now.
Yeah.
There's just so many. I was one of the early adopters for online banking with Citibank, and when they were on a private network, then they went on the internet. That caused me a great deal of concern, and sure enough, almost annually, I would be issued a new debit card because there'd been some kind of breach.
Mm-hmm.
So, it is a cause for concern, and I think it's going to have to be rethought completely. This whole notion, or the way things are done. Maybe we all need secret identities or something, some sort of secret shopping at it. And you mentioned Super Value and Jewel. Jewel is a local Chicago chain that was one of the very first companies that put together the user cards. I forget what they called it at this point, but you had to register and you'd get discounts on goods by using this card, and they were thereby able to collect a lot of data on you. And then quite recently they were one of the early adopters of that, and now they've given it up.
And they
realized that collecting all that data wasn't all that beneficial, or it wasn't worth the expense of collecting it and keeping it. And maybe also they that it wasn't worth to do that.
Yeah.
So maybe all this hyper surveillance, hyper marketing surveillance that we're under, maybe that needs to be questioned.
Yeah, and I think it's going to come down to exactly what you said, is that if it's not returning value for that dollar that they're spending, they're not going to keep doing it. I know I've heard of marketing analysis that's done in some stores that is literally down to the having a camera on you and watching where you go in the store and what aisles pique your interest, what products make you stop and look, and using that data now in somewhat of a somewhat of an aggregated sense, not a disaggregated like what is Dave specifically Sanaki doing here, but in general, what do white males in their 50s go to and do? And I think that
thank you thanks for giving me for saying thinking I was in that age group.
I'm just trying to keep up your, you've got such a youthful vigor about you. It's tough to think that you could be beyond that. But using that kind of information, I think is quite valuable, and is a little cheaper in some senses to collect anyways than like the massive Jewel data collection process that they had going on and subsequently discarded. I think part of it though too is it's easier to get get that info other ways now. You know, if you have access, I mean, if you can just hack into the credit card info, you know everything they bought anyway. So why waste the money on collecting it?
All this is somewhat new. The scope of the ability to collect this data on our behavior, specifically related to shopping or purchasing things, it's fairly new to have this scope, this breadth of information available. At some point, you know, what has to happen before everybody goes, hold on a minute, and you know, there's got to be another way to do this that's safer. And Jay Garman has talked about this on the show before, about the massive settlements that occur as the millions and millions of dollars that for settlements that when a data breach like this occurs. At some point, that's just going to prove too expensive, and folks are going to have to find a way to address it, I think.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think I disagree a bit, though. I think, unfortunately,
that's fine. I disagree. It's good radio.
Yeah. thank goodness. Finally, we're getting some good radio. You know, we spent the first 5 minutes of the show trying to figure out the tech here. The thing of it is, though, is that, again, it comes back down to that money. Is that right now? I think if you talk to a corporate accountant and they say, okay, let's balance the cost that SuperValue is paying in this, you know, data breach and whatever, and the risks that they're taking with it and whatever they did to make sure this didn't happen, but that it did happen, now they're paying out for it, and you weigh that against the value, whether it be a perceived value or a real value, that they gain from having such deep and intimate information and knowledge about their customer base and their market and their demographics therein. I think it would be a tough discussion to say you need to not collect the information because it's too dangerous to hold it. I do think that because of these costs and these painful experiences, we'll see, you know, that continued sort of Cold War increase of security and data protection. But I think that horse has left the barn as far as, you know, whether we're going to collect the data or not.
Ah, well, but Juul opted out. Why? That's who you need to get for an interview. You need to find who made that decision, or who was in on that decision, or somebody, a spokesman from Juul, willing to talk about it.
Yeah, you know,
that'd be fascinating as to why they were one of the pioneers in collecting data on their customers, and they just said no after a while.
Now I would be willing to bet you, and I'm going to make a note to myself, because I think I will try to chase that down a little bit. I think that's a great idea. But I'd be willing to bet you that the response is going to be not that, oh yeah, we stopped collecting data on our customers, but to say this avenue of collecting information was not valuable to us because A, B, and C. And so instead, we're still collecting data on our customers through these other, you know, these other ways. I don't think Juul is not collecting data on their customer and demographics and marketing. I believe that they're just not doing it through that card. Now, that card, too, I don't know if you remember, but I used to always get a little bit of a chuckle, because you'd go in and the client service reps, the customer service reps, were always, you know, instructed to, if you don't have your card with you, they just put in some random number and you'd still get the discount. So most people didn't bother doing it, you know.
I lost my card like immediately, and for a while you could do it with your telephone number. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, once in a while, they'd let you go, but oftentimes sometimes you'd really get stuck at the register while you verified who you were.
Yeah.
So it went both ways.
Yeah. And what we did, what I did is, so we have a phone number. I'm not going to say it out on air, but I've got a phone number.
Go ahead.
You know, actually, it doesn't really matter because the phone number that I use for those services, and this is something I would recommend to anybody who signs up for these, the phone number that I use for these services is not a phone number that will ever connect to me. It goes to a fax machine that I have in my office, and it doesn't ring.
Oh, you're dirty.
Yeah. So I every once in a while I look through the logs, and I can there's just literally like a dozen calls a day to this fax machine. And I know it's not people trying to send me faxes or wrong numbers. It's all of that information collected through Jules and other places where I've used this fax number instead of my real number. And it's great. I love it because I don't have to take the phone calls.
See, that's the kind of solution we need for these data breaches.
Mm-hmm.
We need to give them fax numbers.
Yeah.
We need fax number credit cards something.
And I know I'm doing it again. I'm getting on my Google soapbox, how much I love Google. So this is one of the great things about having a Google Voice number. So I use Google Voice as my primary phone number. So it rings my, you know, home phone, cell phone, whatever I want to. And we've gone down that road many, many times. But one of the best things about it is I get a call from a telemarketer one time and I can block that call from then on. I never have to take a call from that phone number or exchange again. And the other thing I can do too, if somebody really, the nice thing is it's not just it rings and goes to voicemail. You can set it so that it literally blocks. They get a this number has been disconnected message, and so you're taken out of their database right away with it. The other thing you can do if you really get fancy and irritated by somebody is you can create custom voicemail messages for specific phone numbers. And so if somebody's really bugging you, you just have a little fun. I like to do ones that are leading. You know, it's like, hello. Yes, I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you. Could you repeat that? You know? And I let that go for as long as it can, and then finally it goes, you know, beep, and then they can leave a message. I've done that a few times and had some fun.
That's great.
And you can do that to your friends too. You know, quote unquote. I'm making air quotes. Quote unquote friends. You can if you have any left. If you're that kind of a guy like me. you can do that. Hey, you know, speaking of friends, I know we're going to bring Jay on here in a minute. There's something I want to talk to him about. I'm going to skip this one, but since we're talking about big data, I wanted to kick one last thing around with big data. I don't know if you caught this. Oregon, Oracle Corporation, and so this is going to make this difficult to get through this conversation because you got Oracle and Oregon. I don't know if I'm going to be able to say them without getting them confused. Oracle is suing the state of Oregon. They filed a breach of contract lawsuit because of the healthcare database that Oregon was setting up. So they filed this in federal court in Portland to the tune of $23 million in disputed bills. Now, Oracle has actually... it's going both ways, in fact, actually, is because the state has already paid $134 million to Oracle. Oracle, though, claims that they're not paying the remainder, but then Oregon is suing Oracle to say they need to recover some of the money they spent because Oracle didn't do their job. And... And Oregon does not have an operative data system for their online healthcare program, by the way, even after $135 million in expense. So
wow.
Yeah.
Us. Why? You know, we need a company where we can pretend to provide services and get paid a lot.
Yeah, you know, I I've been doing that individually personally for years.
Hey, hello, that's. I don't think it's a good idea to admit that on air,
oh,
Michael.
Oops. But you know, that'll come out in post. I'll get that in post. I'm sure. You know, it's funny though. So just to share something personal here as well though is so I was involved in a quite large Oracle data system program and project myself too. I used an external consultant to assist with it and do some of the programming. I was in charge of the project management itself and all this other stuff. And I can tell you from personal experience that these things are very, very often go out of control. It doesn't matter how tightly you try to manage it. There are so many moving parts and variables that unless you do a truly extensive initial due diligence process before you begin trying to think about how much it's going to cost you to do the program and do the project itself and understand everything that's, like I said, all these moving parts and things that are happening, you're almost guaranteed that you're going to run into a problem or a hurdle or a barrier that you did not expect, that's going to be more costly than you budgeted for, and that it's going to increase the time of delivery beyond where you had even set your outer limits for. And like I said, this has happened to me. I know this. And Oracle is a very complex application and development tool and data system itself. And it's a difficult thing. So I feel for both sides here. I feel for the state of Oregon who dealt with that exact situation that I've had happen to me too. Very painful, very difficult to handle, and you want to point a finger and see who's to blame. And I feel for Oracle too, who's dealing with an end user who did probably not, and I'm assuming, I'm making some guesses, but they probably did not truly understand the complexity of what they were requesting from this company and did not really understand what it was that they wanted to see at the end of the day. They thought they did, but when it comes right down to the nitty-gritty of it, did not really understand it. You also, too, in any type of bureaucratic organization, government or otherwise, you wind up with so many voices and so many competing voices in that environment as far as what you want and what you need to get done, that also puts an extra stressor on it. So it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out. I think it's it's just one of those difficult things where, you know, who's to blame? Everybody wants to point a finger at somebody else, and usually the case is somewhere in the middle.
I've been in the middle of stuff like that, and I've seen it happen, and it's extraordinary when things go off the rails. It's the amount of money and trouble and angst is just unbelievable.
Oh,
when,
yeah.
when you're caught in something like that.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it is. It's just painful. It's painful. And even when you do try to prepare people for the eventuality, and when you do try to, promote a forward-thinking budgetary response process and things like this, a lot of times it doesn't matter because people are reporting to different people who aren't in the conversation and aren't part of the discussion to understand how those things happen. And, you know, I was fortunate we were able to pull things together where I was and have a successful and completed rollout that was over budget, and it was off the chart for the amount of time it took us, but it was a really good product when it was done, and we were able to recover some of that extra expense through some of the efficiencies that the data system brought to us. But a lot of places don't get that lucky, and they don't wind up in a situation or a space where they want to be after having to deal with things kind of out of control. And that's happens.
Well, we've been talking about some heavy tech stuff. Real quickly before we call Jay, how about something on the lighter side? What about have you heard about Hitchbot? Do you know what Hitchbot is?
I have not.
Oh, well, it's an experiment to see if robots can trust humans.
It's basically a
small robot that's has some artificial intelligence, and it has GPS, and it's hitchhiking across Canada. It started off in July 1997, I believe, in Nova Scotia. And it's a project of several different universities. And so they just put the parked the robot on a bench, and it's able to converse with people, and it basically asks people to give it a ride, and it's on its way to British Columbia.
Well, now, this is not testing to see if robots can trust humans. It's to test if they can trust Canadians. This is a different thing,
This has occurred to me. It's actually almost at its goal now, which is pretty good. That's probably twice as long as it would take to drive straight through, really, or to drive at a reasonable pace to get to British Columbia.
Yeah.
It's about 3,500 miles or so.
Yeah. Oh, that is, and that's pretty cool. That is,
is Hitchbot. You could follow Hitchbot on Twitter, and it's Hitchbot, at Hitchbot.com, I think, or something. It's HITCHBOT. And, yeah, it would never make it across. It would never make it out of New York and, you know, in the U.S.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, never mind Detroit or Chicago.
Oh, man. It certainly wouldn't look the same if it didn't make it anywhere. Yeah, so you can go to hitchbot.me, that is, and it'll show you where Hitchbot started and where he's at. And you're right, man, he's almost there. He's from Port Credit, Ontario, traveling from Halifax, Nova Scotia to Victoria, British Columbia, and he's just north of Washington State, so he's got to be within 100 miles or so.
Well, this is actually kind of androgynous, but it sounds more like a lady's voice than a man's voice.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I can buy that. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I don't know what the, I don't know what the point of it's going to be, but it's,
I don't know either.
They've got t-shirts.
Well, that hitchhiking safe for robots, I guess that's the point.
And they've got t-shirts. You can buy t-shirts if you want. The Hitchbot
t-shirts. Yeah.
All right, let's give our good friend Jay a call. I'm going to add him to this one since we got this one working. I'm hoping that, that this actually works. It looks like it's, going to work. Hey, look at that. We got rings and everything.
Hello.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Garment.
Hey.
Things work with Jay, you know? I don't know what it is with
oh,
you, Jay.
Shut up.
They just work. We're glad to have you.
He sounds great. He does. I don't know what he does, what kind of advanced technology he's using, but he always gets through. He always sounds wonderful.
It's a landline.
There you go. Exactly.
It's so advanced, it's old.
Yep. Yep. Oh, man. Absolutely. In fact, it's funny. One of my favorite shows on the podcast are better than ours thing. This is one that you cued me into, Jay, as a matter of fact, is Ask Me Another. And with Jonathan Colton and Ophira Eisenberg and all this, it's an NPR. A deal and all that great stuff, and you can be a participant. You need to be able to call in from a landline, though. They won't let you do it any other way, so
because they have these things called production values.
Okay. Ouch.
Yeah, no, I can't even know.
I personally find them overrated. They haven't done me any good. But as a guy who appears on podcasts, trust me, they're not that important.
I keep promising to pull things out, you know, in post. And what people don't realize when I'm saying that is that that's a completely mythical thing here. There is no post-production here. There's I recorded it and then I put it on the internet, and that was the post-production.
Might lean on a post when you're doing production, but
that's about it. And speaking of landlines and stuff too, there was an interesting news item, because I told Dave he's gonna have to wait. I had an interesting news item I wanted to bring up with you here, but this isn't it. But I did see today on The Verge that the top cable providers now, and we're talking about Comcast and AT&T and Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and others, that they actually now have more broadband subscribers than they do TV customers. So they've finally gone over that edge, and it's a very, very tight edge. Cablevision, Charter, Comcast, and Time Warner Cable have now 49,915,000 internet subscribers, whereas the TV tally is 49,910,000. So what that means is that the number, now of course there's overlap between those, but what it means is that the number of individuals who have just internet is actually outpacing the number of subscribers who have just the TV service, which I find that very, I'm not sure what to think of it one way or the other. I think it's very interesting though.
Well, I'd love to get into these statistics deeply, like A, because I'm a giant nerd, and B, what I've seen ad hoc from other similar statistical analyses is that the TV subscribers still represent far more revenue than internet subscribers. Even when they overlap, the TV portion of your bill has a more higher profit margin than the internet bill. Now, that I think is going to go away, because you keep seeing all these little protests of, you know, DirecTV won't carry this network. You know, call your DirecTV representative and say you want the really obscure channel, you know, that sort of thing.
Yep.
Because they keep demanding higher and higher fees from the cable providers to carry their channel, which then leads to higher cable bills. So I think those margins are going to start shrinking aggressively, because, you know, for all that I download stuff, like I don't think there's any other ancillary fee than just laying the pipe to get internet to my door.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect those margins are going to change. But the other thing that's really interesting to me is the age skew. Is that people under the age of 25 have never had a cable bill in the majority, and they don't ever intend to.
Mm-hmm.
They're only going to get internet. Like, some of them don't even buy televisions. You know, you go to CES, and those guys are terrified that the upcoming generation, the demographic split's going to be that no one buys a television.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting to mention that too. I have heard that quite a bit. Now, we as we age in my house, I keep wanting bigger and bigger TVs. Not necessarily because I want to see things bigger, just because I want to see things as my vision, my distance vision goes bad. But I absolutely have started to get more into the, watching something. Like, my wife loves Orange is the New Black. It's not my thing, and all that. So she'll do that on the TV, and I'll be watching, John Oliver or something else on my iPad, and really kind of, I've kind of gotten into it. You know, I wouldn't want to watch Michael Bay on my iPad, though, and I'm not sure how people handle that type of thing. You know, how do you watch the movies, the big spectacle type of shows, even the kind of period pieces where you've got, beautiful landscape shots and so on. I just feel like you would be missing so much on a small screen. I would have a tough time really making a complete break from the TV experience.
Well, I think what's actually breaking down here isn't the large screen experience, because I know plenty of people who don't own a TV, but they have a 22-inch computer monitor, which, 22 inches from a foot away is about the same as 50 inches from 10 feet away. So
yeah,
the scale there is the same. But what's different about that is they're all watching alone.
Yeah.
Like, they're not... there's not the whole family together watching a show. It's just what you said. It's your wife watching Orange is the New Black while you watch John Oliver last week tonight. You know, at the same time, you're watching separate things.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right. And we are one of the cord cutting generation too. We do not pay for TV in our house. I've got cable and dish TV. I've got Roku boxes, and I've got a Chromecast, and I've got a Plex server, and I've got a subscription to Hulu. And this is how we devour it. And I've got I'm gonna say I have a subscription to Netflix, but I kind of I use a subscription to Netflix, I should say. And that's been more than enough for us. It was a little tough to make the jump to cutting the cord. Only really for me, the only two pieces of it were live sports, and I still have a little bit of pain with that come football season here, which is starting for me this Sunday with my fantasy league. And then the other thing is the it's kind of like the reason I still like to go to the library instead of looking on Amazon is that surfing, running through things and letting things kind of come at you and be exposed to stuff differently, you know, and being able to turn on, 150 cable channels and just kind of flip through. I miss that. And I know it sounds weird, but I do. I miss that in the same way that I miss being able to go to the library and just kind of walk through the shelves and let something jump out at me. If I don't do that frequently.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because there's, even with Spotify really ramping up the charts, there's still a lot of interest in services like Pandora or Slacker, which are effectively music discovery services. We've got this figured out in music. It's like, I like these songs. Show me more songs like this. Mm-hmm. Netflix is really good at this. I like these movies. Show me more movies like that. I don't think anyone's really cracked it very well. Amazon does okay, but no one's really cracked that for books. Because mm-hmm. I think books are so engrossing, and there's so many books out there, and nobody's, to me, cracked this for television.
Yep.
You like these TV shows, you'll like these other TV shows.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, it's interesting that you bring that up with the Pandora model and so on, and that radio type of model, is that you also don't see, and I know that there's been attempts at this. I've run across them on the Roku, and they haven't done a great job of it, but I haven't seen, like, be able to go on and, like, click on the Netflix channel, and it just kind of knows the stuff you want to see and starts playing it, you know, similar to a Pandora. Maybe part of it is like you alluded to with the books, in that it's too great an investment of time right now or of interest for you to kind of just let it flow over you without the option to flip through. Or I'm not sure. I'm grasping.
Well, what I really think is interesting, you know, if you fast forward 30 years, and at some point I promise we'll let Dave talk. If you fast forward 30 years, I think the whole idea of channels is going to go away. Because, I mean, what that really was is this channel is going to put forth, especially like broadcast networks, but even on cable, like there are themed channels. You know, there's the cooking channel, which is about cooking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's you know, the ESPN, which is about sports. But even that's breaking down now where you're getting into, this is NBA TV. This is the NFL network. And or even at the college level, this is the SEC network. This is the Big Ten network. We're getting really down to granular. It's really going to start, I think, getting down to stuff like Facebook profiles. It's like, I like to watch this team. and I might want to watch games which are relevant to that team, like you like the Chicago Bears. And the NFL is probably a bad example because people will watch a lot of that because of fantasy football. But mm-hmm. I only want to see what's going on. You know, I could see a channel in the future of Chicago Bears and then games that are relevant to Chicago Bears because it has an impact on their playoff hopes. Like, that's all I care about, like yeah. divisional games. And that's it, you know, that sort of thing. Or I care about the Chicago Bulls, and I want to see those games and games that are relevant to their standings. And that's it. And like that becomes down to, like, I care about individual broadcast events, and whether it's on ESPN or TNT, like, I don't care. Yeah. I want to give my content provider money to watch this team and content relevant to that team. I want to give people money that can give me everything Josh Whedon has ever put on television or in movies. Mm-hmm. I care about that. And what studio it comes from, you know, what channel it used to be on, I don't care.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. You know, and I think that's, yeah, yeah. I think we're kind of getting to that direction, you know, hopefully. It will make life a lot easier. As we're moving through the time here, I do want to hit this one topic. This is also on a lighter note here. I just thought this was fascinating. I know that they've tried to do this before. We'll see if it sticks this time. Facebook has decided they're going going to test anyways, putting a satire tag next to link titles such as ones from The Onion or other sites that are known for.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea. The Onion's been taking seriously way more times than it should have been.
I find that when that happens, though, really a large part of the humor that I get from. From posting these articles.
It's like literally unbelievable out of business. It's half the humor of The Onion is going into literally unbelievable and seeing what moron doesn't know that satire.
Yes. Exactly. And I've posted stuff, and I've got very smart friends, and I've posted stuff on my page and then had friends respond to it as if it was legitimate stuff too. And So they've got a small test. They've got a little, it's a satire tag that goes, it's in brackets in front of the links so that theoretically you would even see the satire before you clicked through. And they're going to potentially, if this happens, what the idea would be is that they would actually trigger the tag based upon the website domain that you're linking to. So everything at The Onion would be clicked with that satire tag. Now, and I could see that causing some problems, though, too. You know, The Onion, people may not realize, but they do some very serious music and TV review type articles and things like this. So if you posted something through The Onion or the AV network and it came through as satire, that might be a little disconcerting.
I would agree, and I think that's a little heavy-handed of Facebook, although, I mean, pretty much since the Internet was created, like the whole reason we ever had smiley-face emoticons, like going back to Usenet or ARPANET, was so people would understand, could see sarcasm in print.
Exactly.
I don't actually mean this. I'm going to put the little flag on there, smiley-face, you know, I'm joking.
Yeah.
So otherwise, you might think I'm a jerk.
Yeah.
I think there, at some point, this itself sounds like a satire statement, but I'm being serious. I want to put that. We may need to put some sort of contextual flag on articles, like as part of the WS3C standard, to say this is a satire article. This is where you can flag stuff on an individual level.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was actually what occurred to me, but not automated, but a manual flip. Right now, if you go into Facebook and you post, one of the things you can do is you can say, I'm feeling, you know, and you have like 30 different things you can choose or whatever. But one thing that would be kind of neat is take that concept of the drop-down list and apply it to when you post a link, that it's going to show the, you know, cover picture from and link to your friends and so on, is that one of the options that you could have for posting that link built right in is a drop-down that says this article is, you know, frightening, satire, disturbing, exciting, you know, funny, you know, whatever, and push that through. And that way then you would manually tag it how you choose.
Well, it's this comparison, take it out of context, can sound offensive, but internet communication is effectively like having autism, and that they're all of the social cues that persons on the autism spectrum can't mm-hmm. pick up on also aren't present on the internet, so you have to be explicit.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about this is this has been talked about, believe it or not, as part of books, and that automated book readers, not people who's done a performance of reading a book like Audible files, but turning ebooks into things that your e-reader can automatically read out loud, they've talked about developing some sort of emotional tagging system for that behind the scenes, a sort of an emotional hypertext, so that it knows how to intone when the character is being snarky. It knows how to intone the voice. You know, some of that's just really basic, like how do I intone it to be a question as opposed to a statement? How do I know to intone it as yelling as opposed to whispering, that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
But really giving it some sort of a context that text does not natively have, that we sort of, as human beings, have learned how to read into fiction or printed text, but machines just can't possibly do that. And I think, you know, we're probably getting to that point where we need to start putting that kind of emotive hypertext behind things.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's a common thread running through the last two subjects we've talked about. You were talking about making selections for reading a library or television shows or for music. And there's a nuance that's missing from digital information that, for instance, I used to have a huge music collection, and one of the most joyful things I would do would be to just browse through it. And it would be, you know, very pleasant and joyful. And it's quite the opposite experience when you look through a large music collection on a computer. It's tedious, it's tiring, it's boring. So I think we need nuance and across a wide range of, not just on the internet, but through interfaces generally.
Yeah. But for us to become connected again to the information that we're receiving, you know, really is what it comes down to. I think we do have this sense of disconnection, not only from the information, but from the people and that we communicate with. And it kind of leads to that, what you're talking about, that lack of social cues and the ease with which we can disconnect now from everyone around us. You know, we need to bring that back a little bit. That's why I love going to, again, that's why I keep bringing up the library. I love going to the library because you're there, you're present, there's other people around you, and you're just exposed to stuff on such a random basis that you would not otherwise have. I don't think there's a good answer. We should talk, though. Now, speaking of good answers, though, like that segue,
big time segue.
Hey, I've been waiting for that one here now. I had to work that in. So speaking of good answers, though, we need an answer to last week's Geek Trivia, and we've got the Geek Trivia guy, Jay Garman from jgarman.net, right here, and he's going to answer that.
So last week I asked, how many actual transceivers did they manage to fit on the world's first communication satellite, which was Echo 1A, which launched August 12, 1960. So we just passed its anniversary. And the answer is actually zero. The thing about Echo 1A, which was not the first communications device in orbit, but it was the first communication satellite, is it was a balloon. It was literally a 100-foot-wide spherical mylar balloon designed to reflect microwaves. It was literally a passive bouncer. So the first communication satellite in the world had basically no electronics on it. Not none. It had a couple of very minor, basically pinging transmitters on it just so people could find it. But this thing was so big and so reflective, you could see it with the naked eye. It was a giant floating disco ball in the sky.
Wow.
You put it that way, wow, that's cool.
I think we need more of those. It sounds like the similar to what Google's been talking about, though, too, putting these balloons up in the air for extensive Wi-Fi coverage for everybody, free internet for everybody through Google. I like it. You know, there's so many amazing things that were accomplished pre-computers, pre-transistors, you know, pre all of the technology that we just rely upon on a minute-to-minute, not to mention daily basis today. It just astonishes me. Anybody that loves technology should really go and give themselves a little history lesson on our space program in the 60s, or missile production in the 30s and 40s, and it's just astonishing what was able to be accomplished. Cryptography in World War II, it boggles my mind to think about the focus and ability that was present there. And I would just have pulled my hair out and walked out the door because I didn't have my calculator, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I always go back to this. You've heard me say this before. What is staggering is that the SR-71 Blackbird, which is still the fastest aerodynamic plane ever built, was designed with a slide rule. It was natively stealth. It ran so fast it had to launch off the ground leaking gas, so that once it hit full speed and it got so hot, that the gas tank seals would expand and seal up, but it was literally leaking gas on the runway and had to refuel not long after takeoff. Yeah. Because that's how they got around the heat problem. I mean, that thing was all brute force engineering, and it's still one of the greatest things ever designed. It was designed without computers in the 60s.
And you know there was that guy who was in the office with his slide rule, and he's like, yeah, look at this. I just got the new model. It's got the stainless steel, and it's twice the size of yours. Does yours do Celsius to Fahrenheit calculation? Because mine does. You know, I don't think they turned them over quite as quickly as we do our cell phones, but I bet there was a little slide envy going on every once in a while. Well, what should we be thinking about for next week, though?
All right, so this week is the 7th anniversary for the single biggest spam attack ever conclusively recorded. On August 22nd, 2007, the Storm botnet by itself sent 57 million spam messages in one day. What's terrifying is that that's considered a mistake, because that's sort of what gets botnets noticed, is when they all do big surges. The Storm botnet is in the top 5 of all botnets of all time, but it's not the biggest. What is the biggest botnet ever detected, and what is its total spam transmission capacity? It'll never do it because it'll get caught doing it, but based on estimates, what is the biggest total possible spam messages it could send one day?
Ooh, wow. I think I'm not going to want to know the answer to that.
Spam, 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 yeah. Spam, spam, spamity spam.
Actually, my wife and my two younger children went to the Spam Museum when we were on our big road trip, and I have not posted the pictures of that yet. I've been using Flickr. I don't know if we talked about that last time. I've been really kind of enjoying Flickr as a nice alternative to Picasso Web, Facebook only, and Google Photo kind of stuff. So, but I introduced my daughter to Monty Python through the Spam song, because she asked me what was spam, not the meat that I eat in a can, but what was spam. And so I showed her the spam video on YouTube, and to connect it to our earlier conversation, I displayed it on the big screen. I did not do that
cool.
on the computer. So
cool.
Well, Jay,
Monty
I'm...
Python, by the way, just did real quickly. They just did a 10 show reunion thing in London, and there was a satellite broadcast of that you could see in theaters. Hopefully, it'll come out in video.
Yeah,
it was supposed
to be amazing. The guys were just still on top form, and of course, doing a lot of their well known stuff, but with a lot of that just same verve and excitement and passion that they've had throughout their careers. So I disappointed that I did not have the ability and wherewithal to make it out there to see it. But I agree with you, Dave. Hopefully, they've got that on TV somewhere for us to watch.
Be great.
Hey, I am going to let you go, Jay. You know what? I'll let you go too, Dave. I'm going to close us out here. We're right at the end. I've got Rob Shot First on deck. He's going to be on this week. We missed him for a few weeks, so it's going to be cool. He's got some science queued up for us to follow with the tech, and hopefully his physics and science hangs together a little better than our tech did in the beginning here, because I don't want to be floating off into space because suddenly gravity has stopped stopped operating. But we'll be back on next week with Tech Talk as well. So Dave and Jay, both of you, thanks for being on, and we'll talk soon. Have a great week.
All right, have a good one, buddy.
All right, take care, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Dave Sparky Saganaki and Jay Geek Trivia Garmin. You can find more about him at jgarmin.net. He's got a lot of stuff going on all the time. Really good stuff. I am going to mention just one really, really quick cool site of the week, because I had a cool site of the week a couple of weeks ago that is dead now, so I need to replace it. I was a big fan of Swell Radio, which was like a combo, like we're talking about, create your own channel out of of themes and concepts and ideas that you like, and it would play you news and stuff that was related to what you wanted to hear. It's dead. It's in the dead pool. But a new one, or relatively new one, that has been around for longer and is also very good is called Umano, U-M-A-N-O. It is a podcast listening service. Not really. It's actually a listen to articles being read by people. And so what they do is they pick articles from The Verge and Wired and wherever else. You tell it what kind of things you want to hear, and they've got people that have been reading these and recording them, and then that gets played out to you. And it's all free, of course, unless you want to sign up for the advanced version of it. But that's my tip for the day. Umano. Listen to that on your smartphone. I'm going to walk out of here. You got Rob, Shot First, On Deck coming up soon. I'm going to leave you with the podcast-only song of the week. It's by a band called Yella. And the song, I'm going to mangle the pronunciation, it's called Je Veux Te Voir. I have no idea what that means or if this is hopefully appropriate. It's French, so it's got to be appropriate, right? All right, guys, have a great week. Thanks for listening to Tech Talk. You are listening to WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. This is Je Veux Te Voir.